Made possible in part by a grant from Strawberry Fields in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields Catering Department now offers boxed lunches for professional meetings or casual lunchtime gatherings. Strawberry Fields, 328-1655. Programs on WILL are made possible in part by a grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design, gemstone roundtables, and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada.
Thanks to the friends of WILL, whose contributions have helped us maintain a strong program schedule in 2004. Your gifts support almost half our annual operating budget. If you appreciate the programs but haven't yet contributed, consider making a year-end tax-deductible gift. Write a check to the Friends of WILL Radio and mail it to the University of Illinois Foundation, Box 3429, Champaign, 61826. Thank you, and happy holidays.
Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frain, is at the controls. In this hour of the show, we will look into the life of a man that many people consider to be the greatest humorist ever to have written in the English language, P.G. Wodehouse. Certainly, if not the greatest, he may well be the most prolific. Over his long career, he wrote 100 novels, hundreds of short stories. He also wrote or collaborated on 14 Broadway musicals. And among those people who delighted in his work, at least those who got a chance to meet him, he was, in addition to everything else, a bit of a disappointment because they were expecting someone who was bright and witty, and Wodehouse was neither of those things as a person on a one-on-one basis. It seemed that what he wanted to be doing just about more than anything else was writing. He also was something of a controversial figure in the mind of a lot of people because of some radio broadcasts that he made while interned by the Nazis in occupied France during World War II. Back in England, many people considered him a traitor. And after the war, he never went home. He came and lived the rest of his life in the United States. Our guest for this hour of the show is the author of a new biography of Wodehouse. His name is Robert McCrum. The book is titled Wodehouse, A Life, and it's published by W.W. Norton. Robert McCrum himself is the author of 6 novels. He's the co-author of the internationally acclaimed bestseller, The Story of English. He's also authored a book about his personal experiences with stroke, titled My Year Off. That was published in 1998. He now serves as literary editor of The Observer. His home is in London. He is now spending some time in the United States, traveling around talking about the book, and we're pleased that he could be with us here this morning by telephone. Questions certainly welcome. People like to call in. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do have a toll-free line also, 800-222-9455. If you'd like to participate, and if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number. Mr. McCrum, hello.
Good morning.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us today.
I'm delighted to be talking to you.
We certainly appreciate it. One of the things that is striking about Wodehouse was his lifespan.
Yes. Well, he was 93 when he died.
It's astounding. He was born in 1881 and he died in 1975. So yep. Not only did he have a very long life and wrote over all those years, but it's when you think about what happened in the world during that time, it sets one back.
No, he gives you a kind of oblique window on the 20th century, or a sidelong look, and it's or an alternative look, if you like. And he did experience, you know, some of the most important moments of the 20th century. I mean, he was here in America just before the First World War, and he was here all during the Prohibition period, during the Jazz Age. He then went to Hollywood, and he was in Hollywood during the 30s and the early part of the development of Hollywood. And then he was in Germany, as you said in your introduction. Mm-hmm. And then he was back here. So he really did, as you say, span a very tumultuous century.
Yeah. The one detail that sticks in my mind, and actually this is not about Wodehouse, but it's about his father, that maybe again says something about the kind of history that his life touched. The fact that his father, Wodehouse's father, fought at Waterloo.
Grandfather.
Grandfather. Oh, that's a little bit different then. His grandfather fought at the Waterloo.
I mean, it's still pretty amazing. I mean, his grandfather obviously married late. Maybe he had the experience of fighting Waterloo had put him off. I don't know. He married late, and then had Wodehouse, his father, with his wife. But he had indeed been at Waterloo in 1815. So he spans a long period. and his family go way, way back into the Middle Ages. I mean, you can trace Woodhouses all the way back, almost to William the Conqueror. So like his character Bertie Wooster, who's always going on about his ancestry being very distinguished, mm-hmm. Woodhouse himself has a long, distinguished English ancestry.
One of the things that I think that it is true of Woodhouse, and it may both be perhaps a flaw, but certainly part of his charm, is that, as we discussed, he had this very long life. An awful lot happened in the world during that time. But it seems that that not only was he not, in some way, not of his time, he seems, in a way, not to have been of any time.
No, he was, in that sense, a true artist. He lived for his work. And he lived in his imagination. He lived in his head, and he lived in the world that he created so brilliantly in all those books. If I might just correct you very slightly, in your introduction, you said he wrote 100 novels. He didn't write. He wrote about 60 or 70 novels. Then there are also collections of stories and other works. He wrote about 100 books.
Ah,
they weren't all novels.
All right,
but you might get calls about this. People do. And the other thing is that no one can agree exactly how many books he wrote, because there are different versions of different titles in America and in Britain. Mm. And so if two Woodhouses get together, one of the things which will always make them argue is the number of books that hero wrote.
Well, it's certainly true that if you love his writing, there's enough of it to keep you occupied for a long time. For a long, long time. And I think that's probably one of the things that, again, people enjoy, because once you get hooked on it,
there's
plenty more where that came from.
Yeah. I mean, I found when I was commissioned to write this book, and I'd grown up with him, and I'd read, I suppose, 20 or 30 as a boy and then growing up. And then when I came to write the book, of course, I had to read all the others. It was a pleasure to read them all, but I was astonished to find so much wonderful material to work on.
And I guess this also gets at another thing that I mentioned, and I think is true in the introduction, that it seemed that he would rather, almost rather than anything else, he would rather be writing.
Yeah, he loved to write. And in some ways he was born to write. And he was happiest when he was on his own with his typewriter. And he was quite a shy man, and as you said in your introduction, he wasn't a thrill to meet. Hmm. Very charming and sweet, but quite withdrawn, really, I believe.
Hmm.
And when he was very, very famous in the 30s, people would contrive to have dinner invitations and dinner meetings with him, and they would expect a flow of anecdotes and wit and delightful stories, and they always came away very disappointed that he was to them so dull.
There was one story, and I guess I don't recall the particulars, but he was selected to receive some sort of honor, and
yeah.
There was a dinner, and he was given the award, and people were expecting a wonderful, sparkling, entertaining kind of a speech, and he simply said, thank you, and that was all.
And they were very disappointed. That's right. He was given an honor by Oxford University in 1939, and at that point, he couldn't have been more famous. He was more famous then. And any writer is. There's no writer today who is as famous as Woodhouse was in 1939. He was extraordinarily famous in Britain and America.
I guess it's difficult. You have to be a little bit careful about trying to apply psychology and looking at people's lives and their childhoods and so forth, and the kind of person that they become. But it's also difficult to not to do that. And it seems that in his case, his childhood, his relation or relationship or lack thereof with his parents maybe goes some way to explain the person that he was, perhaps why he became a writer, why he wrote the sorts of things that he did. See, certainly it seems not to have been particularly close to his parents, and perhaps also that wouldn't have been particularly unusual for people of his class of his time.
No, I mean his experience was one which was shared by a number of other writers, Orwell, Kipling, particularly. And what you're referring to is the fact that from a very early age he was brought up really by governesses, by aunts, of course, who were featured in his writing, and by schoolmasters, and so he didn't have a family life really. And he never really understood what family life was like, although he did have brothers. But it was completely normal. This, as you said at the beginning, he was born in the end of the Victorian period, when the British Empire was at its height. And as the son of a colonial judge, his father was a judge in Hong Kong. His parents lived; both his parents lived in Hong Kong, and he I mean, it seems barbarous to us today, but in those days it was quite normal. He was shipped back to England at the age of three, and he didn't see his parents. He saw his parents for a total of 6 weeks up to the age of 15, which does strike us as strange, and not to say inhuman, but it was quite common then, and it did make a number of writers. And I think, I mean, as you said, I agree with you, it's dangerous to psychoanalyze the dead, but it's perfectly clear to me that... he found an escape into a fantasy world from a painful childhood existence. To put it very simply.
Just to go back to that statement that you made, I just want to make sure that people got that. That is, between the time that he was three and the time that he was 15, how much time did he spend with his parents?
About 6 weeks.
About 6 weeks.
Mm-hmm. The reason we know that is because his parents came home on leave from Hong Kong for about 6 weeks when he was about 6 years old. The only time he saw them, and actually he forgot them so much that when his mother reappeared in his life at the age of 15, when his father retired from Hong Kong and came back to England, the first time that she walked into the room, he thought she was just another aunt. He had no idea who she was.
Hmm.
And she was, I think, she was also a pretty formidable woman, and quite fearsome, and he wasn't close to her. It didn't really get on. She was hard on him. He was wayward, dreamy, bookish, and I don't know what. I mean, he never really talks about her, but it's clear from the kind of aside that she was a tough nut.
Well, and I think it's also true that in the decade after his father died, Woodhouse saw his mother exactly once?
Yeah, that's right. And he would only go and visit her in the company of one of his brothers for some moral support. I think she terrorized him rather the way that Aunt Agatha terrorizes Bertie in the books.
Hmm. What, do you see some, this is leaping ahead a bit, but also his, the woman that he married, that Woodhouse married, also she sounds remarkably like his mother.
She's more fun.
Well, I guess some people found her difficult and unpleasant. Maybe that's what I'm thinking of.
Some people did, but she was a great party goer. She was what you might call frivolous. She was tremendously good fun. She loved to party. She loved to go to shows. She loved drinking, and she carried on like nobody's business, using his money. But she never lost sight of the fact that her first job was to look after him. And I think there was something about him. You know, he was in some ways quite clueless and quite helpless, and he needed people to look after him. And his wife was one of the people that he surrounded himself with to look after him. It was unquestionably a strange marriage, but it was a very affectionate one. It lasted until his death, in fact.
Mm. Well, he apparently was devoted to her, and also to her.
Absolutely.
Her daughter.
Yes.
That he was very much taken with, and I guess one of the more difficult moments in his life was this daughter, his stepdaughter. She died after some surgery, I believe, and it sounds like that was something that he really never recovered from.
I think that's right. I mean, he of course never talks about it, but because it would have gone against his breeding, really, to go into the details of his feelings. But he was shattered, really, and it was a contributory factor to his coming to America, because it happened at the end of the Second World War. He was already in disgrace as a traitor, as an alleged traitor, and he felt he couldn't go back to England. Once his daughter died, Leonora died, stepdaughter died, really, America was the only place for him to go. And so I think her death propelled him in this direction.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Robert McCrum, and he's the author of a new biography of the British humorist P.G. Woodhouse. It is published by Norton and is out now if you'd like to read it. Robert McCrum himself is the author of 6 novels, 2 works of nonfiction, including the book that I mentioned that's his story of getting over a stroke, My Year Off. He's also one of the authors of the book The Story of English. He is literary editor of The Observer, makes his home in London, and he's now spending some time in the United States to talk about Woodhouse, and was good enough to spend some time with us. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. As you mentioned a bit ago, Woodhouse was born in Hong Kong, where
he,
his...
is actually born in England, but he was shipped back to Hong Kong.
Oh, I see. All right. Well, his parents were colonial administrators there in Hong Kong.
That's right.
And that when he was then 3 years old, he was sent back to England.
That's right.
Was cared for by family there, and also went to school there. And apparently this, for him, was actually a great experience. He loved Dulwich, the place where he went to school, and was very successful there.
No, he never really left school, in a way, and he remained a Dulwich boy till the end of his life at heart. And there's a wonderful moment in 1944, the end of the Second World War, when he meets Orwell in Paris, and they have lunch together. And the conversation turns not to the war, or to their respective difficulties in the war, or the second, or the liberation of France, or anything. What they talk about is the football scores between Eton and George Orwell had been at Eton and Dulwich, and so he was somebody for whom school was very vivid and very important because it gave him. I've already described how he didn't really have a family. It gave him a kind of surrogate family.
And at the same time, he didn't seem to have a lot of friends.
Not close friends. I think he was somebody who was liked but not closely liked. I mean, he was sort of popular, generally popular, but he was, I think, a little bit aloof.
Hmm. After he left there, he really wanted to go to Oxford. And his father apparently said, "Well, I can't afford to send you to Oxford," and got him a job at a bank in London.
It was a great blow.
What was it? Was it really the case that his family couldn't have afforded to send him to Oxford?
It's controversial. No one knows really why he had difficulty with his father had difficulty with the Oxford. The move to Oxford. He had just retired, and he was being paid in rupees. His pension was being paid in rupees, and he felt he couldn't afford to send him. Actually, when you examine, I do this in the book, when you examine the costs of sending a boy to Oxford and so forth, it's clear that he could have afforded it, but maybe he was just nervous. And I think there's also a suggestion that one of his elder brothers, and he didn't really get on and didn't want... But Woodhouse was very bright, and I think his elder brother felt threatened by him in some way, and he just said, "I don't want him to go to Oxford." But actually, I think maybe Oxford's loss was our gain, because if he had gone to Oxford, he would unquestionably have become an academic professor, and would have become, I think, probably a classics professor, is my guess, because he was a very accomplished classicist. And instead, he went to the bank, and. Which was a shock, obviously, to have to earn a living at the age of 19 when he had expected to go to Oxford. But the bank forced him to follow his instincts and become a writer, because he worked as a freelance writer in his spare time while at the bank. And after 2 years at the bank, he set out, as he said, on his wild loan to make his way in the world as a writer. And really, to the end of his days, not a day passed when he wasn't writing something.
Mm. So he's
extraordinary range of stories, lyrics, plays, films, novels, letters. An incredible, I mean, when I've been working on this book, I've had to digest an incredible mass of paper.
And one of the things that it's said of him, and seems to be the case, is that, well, as you say, he had got this job in the bank. He hated it. And so he wrote for escape and for pleasure, and because he disliked his work so much. And one of the things that's said about him is that, you know, if you look at writers and you look often at their early work, it's really not very good. And so you see over time how it is they get better. It seemed that Woodhouse was pretty much Woodhouse right out of the blocks, and that his early work is just about as good as his mature work or his later work, for that
matter. I wouldn't completely agree with that. I think his early work is, I mean, it's still in print, it's still being read, you can still get it, which is remarkable. But it's quite different, really. I mean, his early work were school stories. There was a real market in those days for books about public school, that's our private school, about school boys and school activities. And there was a real market for it, and he wrote those kinds of stories. And his... They weren't particularly funny. They were light. They were very light, sort of humorous. They weren't avowedly funny. It was only later that he became. You introduced him as a great humorist, which indeed he is. He's a great humorist and a great stylist. That didn't happen until the 20s.
We have a caller to talk with. Let's do that. Someone listening this morning in Aurora, and that is line number 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
As a first-time reader of Woodhouse, what would you suggest as a book to read, and what is his most popular book?
That's a very good, interesting question. I think his most popular is the one which has sold the most copies, and it's a collection of stories, and it wouldn't be a bad way to start, but it's a collection of stories called The Inimitable Jeeves, which was published in 1923. That's still very easily available in paperback, in Penguin, in the shops. The one I would read to start with is a book called The Code of the Woosters.
The Code of the...
Woosters. Woosters.
What is a Worcester?
Well, it the name comes from the hero, Bertie Worcester.
Oh, okay.
And I think that's probably the one which I would recommend to a first timer. But I'd also get the collection of stories, The Inimitable Jeeves. Jeeves is spelled Jeeves.
Okay.
If that's any help.
Thank you.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Well, again, thanks for the call. And others are welcome to call 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. It is because of Woodhouse that in the popular imagination, all British butlers are named Jeeves.
Yes.
Because he created this character named after a cricket player, apparently.
What we call a fast bowler, which is, in your terms, a pitcher.
Mm.
Called Percy Jeeves, who actually died in the first world. He was killed on the Somme, but Woodhouse saw him bowl, I guess, in the Edwardian period, and the name stuck in his mind, and he adopted the name for his butler.
It's interesting that here you wrote a number of stories about this character, Bertie Wooster, and his man Jeeves, and that if people have read any of these, or perhaps they've seen some of the adaptations that have been done for television, that they know, of course, that Bertie is a colossal goof, and that Jeeves is always bailing him out and taking care of things and helping him out. He appears to be the only one who has any sort of sense. Is there any sort of political dimension to this relationship and the fact that here it's the man who really is the working class man, so to speak? It seems to be the only one in these stories, or the one who reliable in these stories indeed has any sense.
I don't think that, Woodhouse was totally apolitical, really. And I don't think you can, really, the butler is, he's sort of classless in some strange way.
Hmm.
And I don't think you can fit him into that particular straitjacket. I think there is a kind of mild social satire in the stories, but really, it doesn't really fit that description.
So Woodhouse wasn't particularly intending to make any kind of commentary on class in Britain with the stories.
I think it was a portrait of a world that in those days it was very common in London and all over England, but particularly in London. For young men who had inherited wealth to have what were called gentlemen's gentlemen, Jeeves is not really a butler, but he's not a valet either. He's a gentleman's gentleman. His job is to run the household, look after the young master, take care of him, and be his sort of minder, really.
Hmm. We have, I think we have somebody else getting lined up here to talk. And, of course, other people who are listening, if you have questions, you'd like to get in on the conversation, you can do that. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. A caller in Dalton, and this is our line number 4. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
I'd like to know what the first novel of Bertie Wooster is and what the last novel of Bertie Wooster.
Yes, well, There are very many. The first one is probably a book called Thank You, Jeeves. The reason I'm hesitating because there are so many, and I don't recall them all right now, and I didn't actually have the book. But in my book, there's a list of all the books.
Oh, okay.
At the end, which will help you. And then later on, the last one was probably. A book written. I was probably one of the books written in the late 1960s. I forget the title now. The titles are fairly unmemorable. The last one.
I read Joy in the Morning.
Joy in the Morning is very good, and the one that, I think My view is that he kind of goes off towards the end of his life. They're interesting. There's some lovely moments, but they aren't as good as the main ones.
I also read Du Butler's Burgle Banks. And
yes.
I did read the one that you were talking about, The Code of the Woosters.
Mm.
And I found that very interesting.
I think another good one, which is very enjoyable, is The Mating Season.
Oh, I haven't read that one.
The Mating Season, another one called Pigs Have Wings. These are all quite late on. But the first one, which is hilarious, is Thank You, Jeeves, which is great.
Okay, thank you very much.
And, of course, there are also the stories. And, I mean, when we talk about Bertie and Jeeves, we shouldn't overlook the fact that he wrote stories and novels about many other characters, too. And stories about Lord Emsworth and his famous pig, the Empress of Blandings. Stories about a character called Smith, spelled P-S-M-I-T-H, Smith.
Well, was Blandings a different... characters then?
Quite different.
Okay.
Occasionally, Bertie would stray into that world, but only very occasionally. They're really a different series. The thing about Woodhouse is that his work was really conceived for the weekly magazines, like the Saturday Evening Post, for serialization. And you had to have what he called a serial character for those. And so Lord Emsworth was a serial character, Bertie was a serial character, Jeeves is a serial character, and there's some other ones, but those are the main ones.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. We have another caller here. We'll get to them in just a moment. Maybe I'll reintroduce our guest, Robert McCrum. He is the author of a new biography of P.G. Woodhouse. It's published by W.W. Norton. It's titled Woodhouse, A Life. It's about the life of the British humorist. Had a very long career. He died in 1975 at the age of 93. He wrote so many books, it's almost difficult to keep track of them. A great many novels, short stories. He also wrote or collaborated on a number of Broadway musicals. Questions are welcome, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free 800-222-9455. We'll go to another caller. Here's someone listening this morning in Indiana on our line one. Hello.
Hello. I have a number of questions, if they're quickies. Has the WODE ever been pronounced as Wode House in any in the history? You said it went all the way back near 1066.
No, it's pronounced Wood.
I know it's pronounced Wood. I was just wondering, you know, as a young child, I first read him in a library when I was put there, almost like he was put in a school. And I remember I saw the WODE, and I just, you know, was maybe 4, 5, 6 years old, something like that. I thought that was Wode House. And somebody who knew those things, you know, explained it to me that, it's actually pronounced Woodhouse. Mm. And that was just interesting in terms of whether those combination of letters may have changed over a long period of time and eventually became known as Wood instead of Wode, that's all. Much Obliged Jeeves in 1971.
Mm.
I'm looking into an Encyclopedia of Comparative Literature right now.
That's probably one of the very last ones.
Yeah, uh-huh. And I was wondering, somewhere in my history, I think I saw a film. I think there were two films, I think they were American-made, that dealt with Jeeves, at least in the title. I think one had David Niven.
There were two films made in the 30s, one with David Niven, and both with Arthur Treacher.
Yeah, thank you very much.
They're not very good.
I can see that. I collect films for other reasons than whether they're, you know, other good or anything like that. I just like Arthur Treacher, for example. That's,
and he's a great character, but they didn't really have much to do with the fiction.
Okay, that was my next question, and was whether that was true or not.
What happened was just to get technical for a moment, the studios bought the rights, and they really bought the rights to the character, and then they made the character do other things.
Yeah, that's pretty common. Now, the next thing is, I have a rather large collection of old films from the 30s and 40s, and I'm trying to remember, and I can't remember any place that I've seen a film that was actually written, you know, he being actually the screenwriter. So I thought if you could help me. Now, if it's in your book, then I can take care of it that way.
Well,
I was just wondering, are there a couple of films that you know, fairly well-known, or at least, you know, you would know about, that he actually was a screenwriter?
The book goes into his screenwriting career. There's one chapter particularly which deals with it, which might be interesting to you.
Okay.
But the only film where he played a significant role is a film called Damsel in Distress.
Yeah.
With Fred Astaire.
Right. Okay.
Well, but he was really written out of that.
Okay.
But he was involved quite heavily. I don't have the credits in front of me. But you probably have the credits to hand. But it's based on one of his novels. He played a big role in the script, and it wasn't a very successful film because it was Fred Astaire without Ginger Rogers.
Yeah.
But it came out in about 1937, I guess.
Yeah.
And that was really his only. He was involved in a number of films in the very. He gets a small credit in probably about six films.
Yeah. Well, it says here he wrote more than 20 film scripts, so that's not.
Totally untrue.
That's not clear. I mean, he was just part one of the writers in that sense then.
But in those days, scripts, as you know, were written by several people, and he, I think he played a very, very minor role in about maybe a dozen films.
Okay. Okay, well, thanks a lot.
All right, well, thank you again. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. A lot of people probably in the United States will know about Jeeves and Wooster from the series that aired here on American public television that starred the two British comic actors, Hugh Laurie and Stephen Fry.
Yes.
What do you think of them?
Well, I think they're very good, but I think they aren't really the books because they are the characters. But if you know the work, the episodes of Fry and Laurie, so to speak, are really a kind of collage of Woodhouse's situations stuck together by the filmmakers for cinematic purposes, but they aren't, and you can recognize bits of plots, but they aren't really representations of whole stories. So they're kind of reinterpretations, but they're very good. I mean, I think Laurie particularly is very, very good as Bertie.
Hmm. I want to make sure, before we find ourselves out of time, that we talk about an event in the life of Woodhouse that you concentrate on. You have a significant a section in the book about, and was the thing that I mentioned at the beginning, where in his time, some people thought he was a controversial figure, not to say a traitor, and didn't feel welcome at home in England, and then after the war came and lived in the United States. And this was these events that took place during the time that he was being held by the Nazis in occupied France. First, maybe just from the beginning, we could talk about the fact that how it is he happened to be there and didn't manage to get out before the Nazis came in, and how he came into their hands in the first place.
Let me, before I answer that point, let me make one point. People have said, why have I, you said I've concentrated on the war. Well, I've concentrated on it only because it's the one thing which comes up all the time about him. It is really the big event in his life. And I've devoted, I've devoted a chunk of the book to it, but not more than an appropriate chunk. Anyway, that's just by the by. It is the thing which people remember him for, as well as being very funny. He was living in France really for tax reasons. He was living in northern France in a seaside town called Le Touquet, which is about 10 miles south of Dunkirk. And in 1939, when war broke out, there was a thing called the Phony War. And war was declared, but then Hitler did nothing, you may remember. And he didn't invade France until May 1940. Now, you might say, why didn't Woodhouse leave when war was declared? And the reason he didn't leave was because he was writing a book. He was such a dedicated artist. He didn't want to leave he didn't want to break up his writing routine. Plus, he didn't want to put his dogs into quarantine. He had Pekingese dogs, and to bring them to England, he would have had to quarantine them. He's very attached to his dogs. Didn't want to do that, so he stayed in France because he reasoned, I guess, that in the previous First World War, when the Germans invaded France, they didn't get very far. But it was a fatal mistake because when the Blitzkrieg began in May 1940, as you know, the British Army retreated and escaped at Dunkirk. The German Army rolled on down the coast, occupied Le Touquet, occupied large tracts of northern France. The regime fell and France became German temporarily. And Woodhouse was arrested, not for the reason that he was resident. He was arrested as an enemy alien. And he was 59 years old, and under the terms of the Geneva Convention, enemy aliens in occupied territory were interned in camp. And so he was, along with a lot of other Englishmen, sent to a camp Now, when we use the word internment camp, we have to be very careful here, because there were many kinds of camp in Germany in the Second World War, ranging from obviously the worst, the dreadful Auschwitz and Birkenau and so forth, the concentration camps, the extermination camps. Then there were non-extermination camps. Then there were camps for captured officers. There were camps for captured ordinary soldiers, camps for civilian internees. They were usually converted prisons or hospitals. And the one he was sent to was a converted lunatic asylum in a place called Tost, which is near the Polish town of Katowice. In those days, the area was called Upper Silesia, which gave him a good joke. He said, if this is Upper Silesia, what must Lower Silesia be like? Anyway, he was interned in this... the building is actually still there. You can still see where the camp was in this lunatic asylum in Poland. And he spent a year in captivity. Many of the inmates, some of them committed suicide. Some went mad. So they were all very deprived of food. They were very hungry. And it was a very tough situation for him.
So how is it then that the Germans approached him about doing these radio messages?
Yes. Well, so the reason he was interned was, bad luck. It wasn't because he was a particular a political figure or a criminal or anything. He just happened to be in France. And while he was in camp, in order to enter, he was very famous. And of course, the camp, all the camp, which were basically other Englishmen who also caught in France, they knew who he was, and they asked him to write stories for them. And he developed a series of talks for his fellow inmates. And they were basically funny talks about life in camp, about the quality of the food, the quality of the latrines, the dormitories, and so forth. They were just humorous talks. They had no political content whatever. And they went down very well with his fellow inmates. And after a while, the Germans got wind of this, and they thought, well, maybe we could use this stuff on the air, on the airwaves, the radio airwaves, to make our regime seem less barbarous. And they asked him to make, there were five 10-minute broadcasts. And it was a great mistake, he accepted. And he accepted because for two reasons, well, for many reasons. First of all, he wanted to they were originally to have been broadcast to America, which at that point was neutral, wasn't in the war. And he wanted to thank the many hundreds of people who'd written to him while he was in camp, and to use the broadcast as a way of saying thank you for the letters and food parcels and so on that had arrived. And also because they'd gone down well in camp with his inmates, he felt it was okay to do this. But of course, as we know, it was a great grave error of judgment to have anything to do with the Nazi radio and so forth. Hmm. Although the talks themselves, which were recast from his camp talks, are utterly harmless, they gave grave offense in England and grave offense here in America. And he was denounced, as you said at the beginning, as a traitor. And his life was really ruined.
And eventually, did the majority of public opinion get around that in Britain?
Very slowly. Really, throughout the 50s, I think, there was... I mean, even today, people... I got myself into quite a feverish discussion only 6 months ago with somebody who was an older person, I should say, someone in the 60s, who said, how can you spend your time writing about a traitor? And that misperception lingers. It is a misperception. I devote the section that I do to it in the book because I want to establish once and for all that he was completely innocent of all the charges that were laid against him.
Hmm.
But it lingered on. I mean, it's still there in the background. Nothing like as bad as it was, but it's still there a bit. Although I think I've been struck by, while I've been over here, how in America people either don't know about the wartime business or don't care about it. And say, well, he's a great writer, so what does it matter?
We have about 15 minutes left in this hour of Focus 580, talking with Robert McCrum about his new book. It's titled Woodhouse: A Life, a biography of the British humorist P.G. Woodhouse, published by W.W. Norton. Robert McCrum himself is literary editor of The Observer and makes his home in London, and he's now spending some time in the United States talking about the book. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We have talked some about Woodhouse, his writing. Another aspect of his life that we haven't talked about, and I'd like to have you do that, is his involvement with Broadway. And how is it that at that time he came to the United States and became involved with writing for Broadway?
Broadway. Well, he came to America. Goes back to the original point. He always seemed to be mixed up with history. He came to America when the First World War broke out. He came here for a commission. He was sent over by a magazine to interview John Barrymore. He arrived in New York the day before war broke out. And once war broke out, it became dangerous for him to go back across the Atlantic, so he stayed. And while he was in New York, this is 1916 now, he bumped into an old friend from his Edwardian London days, where he'd worked for the musical theatre in London. And while he was in London, he'd worked with the very young Jerome Kern. And Kern by 1916, was one of the kings of Broadway. He bumped into his old friend, Plum Woodhouse, and said, come and work with me and my writing partner, Guy Bolton. And so the three of them, Woodhouse and Bolton and Kern, became, in the words of George Kaufman, the American humorist and critic, the trio of musical fame. And they pioneered a number of musicals in a little theatre which, alas, has now disappeared, called the Princess Theatre in Midtown Manhattan. And the thing about the Princess Theatre was that it was very small and you could only have very small casts, and and they were kind of studio productions, really. And Woodhouse did the lyrics for provided Kern with lyrics to his music. And he was unusual, Woodhouse, because on the whole, in musicals, lyricist likes to write the lyrics first and have the music follow. Kern, who was quite a tricky character, didn't like to do that. He liked to write the music and then let the lyricist follow his lead. And Woodhouse was happy to do that. So that was unusual, but they worked well together, and they were very successful. At one point in 1917, Woodhouse and Kern had no less than 5 shows on Broadway simultaneously, which is an amazing achievement.
Does much of that survive?
It's occasionally revived, very occasionally. I wish they would revive some more, but it's. I think that they don't work that well these days. You can get. I've got a CD of some of them, but they do sound rather dated now, I must say. But the music is delightful. Kern was really a genius.
When Woodhouse came to the United States after World War II in 1947, he continued to work. He continued to write, apparently, because he could not do anything else. And he continued to write the same stuff because he apparently could not do anything else. At that time, though, it seemed that the interest for the kind of things that he did really was starting to wane.
Now, he says somewhere, and I use this in one of my chapters, is that my world has been shot to pieces. The world of butlers and silly young men in spats throwing bread rolls at each other in clubs. had gone. And it wasn't until the mid-50s when there was a kind of mini nostalgia for that world that he began to kind of come back again. And so initially he had a very difficult time. His first 5 years or so in New York, actually. In fact, in an apartment, I'm sitting in an apartment on Park Avenue, belongs to my wife's family, and I'm actually looking at the apartment roof where he lived. And he lived here for 5 years on 1000 Park Avenue, and I can see the roof that he himself used to sit on.
Was that part of his life? The end of his life? Was it unhappy? Was it happy? Was it just what it was? How did he feel about things at that point? Well, you talked about the fact that world that he perhaps loved and had written about was gone and was destroyed. How did he feel about that?
Well, he was a very stoic figure. He always worked his way out of a crisis, and so he just worked. But I think he was sort of depressed, really, and sad. I think my view is that the broadcast business really wrecked his spirits for the rest of his life. And I don't think a day passed between the moment he gave the broadcast until his death when he didn't reflect ruefully on what he'd done. He He never really understood what the offence was, but he knew he'd given grave offence. He didn't know what it was really. He could never grasp the moral implications of dealing with the Nazis.
He was offered a knighthood. I guess he did receive it, although he apparently at the time was not well enough to go to to Britain to do it.
Yeah.
How did that happen?
Well, it was you're talking about did public opinion change? Well, public opinion did change, and it was really the way of the British establishment saying that they'd forgiven him. And he got it, oddly enough, in the same batch of honours as Charlie Chaplin, another Englishman who'd made his reputation in America.
When you think about the appeal of his writing and the work, I can understand it, and yet one wonders what exactly it is, and it may have something to do with being able to, at least for some time, inhabit a world that feels safe, where you know the limits of the known world, you kind of know who the people are. It's interesting, not very long ago, I talked with someone who has authored a new annotated collection of the Sherlock Holmes stories, and it's interesting that apparently Doyle was a friend of, or at least was an acquaintance of, Woodhouse.
Yeah.
It seems there's something about both of those writers and the way people feel about those stories that seems in some way to operate in the same way to me.
Curious parallels. And it's a kind of, I mean, I don't wish this to be misunderstood. It is a kind of escape. It's not escapist, but it is an escape. And they happen to be writers of genius. They're great writers. They're minor writers, but they're very great writers. Well, certainly Woodhouse is. He's a great, great stylist. He's in there, for me, and one of the things I've tried to do in the books, I want to say that he's really one of the part of the English canon of writing, along with Jane Austen and anyone else you care to name. He's a minor figure, but a very, very great one, and a genius, really. I think what the stories and the books offer is a kind of escape, a safe world, a funny world, a world that cheers you up, makes you feel better. A world where, although everything seems to be going crazy, it is curiously stable in some way.
Hmm. Technically speaking, sort of one writer to another, when you look at Woodhouse and his writing, the way that he does what he does, what about it do you admire? Are there cases where you look at particular things, you look at sentences, you say, I wish I had written that?
All the time. But I think one of the thing that I've often discussed with other writer friends about Woodhouse is sometimes you can't see how. Generally, if you've written, as I've written, a certain amount of fiction, you can generally see how you generally know what they're up to. You can see how they're getting their effects and how it's working. But with him, there are some books like Heavy Weather, for example, Summer Lightning, Hill of the Whispers we mentioned. There are passages there, and you just can't see how he's done it. It's just so brilliant. And it's a really masterstroke. That's why I say he's a genius, because it is it's just so brilliant. It's shimmering and it's very hard to analyze. And when you start to analyze it, and I've tried not to analyze it too much in the book, although there is plenty of discussion of the work in the book as well as the life. But when you start to analyze it, you can end up looking pretty foolish.
When you look at his, perhaps particularly his education, but anything else in his experiences, when you look for the roots of his craft, can you find them? Can you point to some things you say, well, now at least I see where some of that comes from?
Oh, well, I mean, yeah. I mean, the silly master and the wise servant goes back to Roman comedy. I mean, that's a classical thing, and that has got roots of 2,000 years old, and actually, when you see a TV series like Frasier is obviously written by people who love Woodhouse. I mean, Niles and Frasier, their relationship is pure Woodhouse.
Hmm.
And so I think there are continuities between his work and the present situation and for the past too.
When you have done when you've spent time with, in a manner of speaking, time with the man, and have tried to explore his life and learn who he was, and explore some of the darker corners, perhaps. And
there
so
were many dark corners, I must say.
Well, maybe I'm thinking of this one major, the one major thing at least.
Mm. The wartime.
The wartime experience, maybe have had some appreciation for this thing that I mentioned about how people read the books and are think that they're delightful, and then they met him and were very disappointed in what he was like. Having some appreciation for Woodhouse the man, what happens when you bring that to now reading Woodhouse? Does it change at all the way you look at it?
I mean, Shakespeare wasn't a bundle of fun, apparently. I mean, you know, why writers should be particularly wonderful company? If their books are wonderful or their work is wonderful, that's good enough for me. Hmm. I think I do know him pretty well now. I've spent 5 years in his company, and I'm sorry to be saying goodbye to him in some respects. But he remains a delightful writer. An interesting man, a man who spanned, as you say, an extraordinary period of time, a very tumultuous period of time. A man loved in Britain and America, passionately by some people, who, as I say, cheered people up. And I think, you know, he died on Valentine's Day in 1975, which is actually rather appropriate because his books are in some ways all about love in a kind of absolutely mad way. They're all about young men falling in love, girls trying to avoid getting engaged, and so forth. And the snags of that kind of romantic comedy.
Well, that's as good as any a place for us to stop, as we've come to the end of the time. For people who are listening, if you're interested again in reading more about the life of P.G. Woodhouse, the book is titled Woodhouse: A Life, by our guest Robert McCrum. It's published by W.W. Norton. Robert McCrum himself is the novelist, author of 6 novels, 2 works of nonfiction. He's the literary editor of The Observer, makes his home in London. He's now spending some time here in the United States talking about Woodhouse. And Mr. McCrum, we thank you very much for talking
with
us today.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
Our show, Focus 580, is made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates, this year celebrating their 22nd anniversary. Bodywork has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. The broadcast also comes from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium in Urbana. For the holidays, the Corkscrew, along with Vosges au Chocolat in Chicago, offers gift baskets and box sets of wine, candy bars, chocolate, truffles, cocos, and more. Information available at thecorkscrew.com. That's where we leave it, but we want you to stay tuned. Up next, The Afternoon Magazine, the host, Celeste Gwynn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of The Afternoon Magazine, we'll take a look at life in a fundamentalist Christian church. In the early 1980s, sociologist James Ault Jr. began studying fundamentalism. He was interested in the rise of the religious right. And with the blessing of a pastor, the